John Herr grew up in the Monongahela Valley of western Pennsylvania when the steel industry was the economic foundation of the region. Now John Herr is a labor journalist and a senior writer for Businessweek. He has returned frequently to the valley to report on the collapse of the region's steel industry. During a 1982 visit, he saw a for sale or lease sign over the old Jones and Laughlin steel plant. He thought it was a bold stroke advertising a mile-long steel plant as if it were a corner grocery. There are many economic and technological reasons for the decline of the American steel industry, but the reason that most interests her is the inability of labor management relations to adapt to changing economic conditions. He says each side blamed the other and stood aside as jobs dwindled. The result of those years of neglect is summed up for her by the remarks of a United Steelworkers vice president in 1983. The union leader said, "One of the problems in the mills is no union man would trust any of the companies. To the average union man, they're always crying wolf, and the wolf finally came." John Herr has written a new book on the decline of the American steel industry. He titled it, "And the Wolf Finally Came." Herr worked in the steel mills when he was a student during breaks from school. I asked him if he ever considered doing it as an adult.
It was an option, but something I never considered seriously. Very frankly, when I was growing up in the 40s, in the late 40s and early 50s, I really did want to move away from McKeesport and get into some other field.
Why?
Well, McKeesport is a very small town and sort of limited, and as much as I liked it in some respects, had great friends and family there, it wasn't a place that I wanted to spend the rest of my life in. By the time my generation came of age in the late 40s, most of us were thinking really of moving out of the Mon Valley, out of the steel industry, and into some other career. Things had opened up very much after the Second World War, that is, new career possibilities going into, and especially many of us went on to college and got higher education. And there just seemed to be much better prospects in the wider world than staying in the Monongahela Valley.
Well, when you were growing up, the steel industry was doing quite well and was the primary industry in the area you grew up in. Can you just give us a little sense of how things in your town related to the steel industry?
Well, for a long period of time, starting in the 1870s when steel first came to the Monongahela Valley, up until at least the late 1930s, the companies really dominated the towns. They dominated the politics, dominated the economics, in some cases even prevented other large employers from coming in so that they could have access to the labor force. In other words, it was steel practically owned, in quotes, those towns in the Monongahela Valley. When the union came in, finally, in the late 1930s, the political domination of the companies began to cease. The union began to get some of its own people elected to town councils and school boards and things of that kind. And at the same time, but the economic dependence on the steel industry never really decreased, not until just very recently when the steel industry, for large purposes, for large intents, actually moved out of the Mon Valley. And so the industry dominated our lives. It dominated our lives environmentally because I can remember vividly that you could hardly move any place in the valley without seeing the huge, bright orange burst of the Bessemer furnaces high in the sky, always rusty red smoke in the sky, the smell of coke and burning materials, and great amounts of soot falling over us practically all of the time. And so it was a very closed environment in many ways. People didn't travel very much out of the small steel towns. A trip to Pittsburgh, which could have been anywhere from 46 miles up down the river to only 12 miles down the river from where I lived, a trip to Pittsburgh was almost an unknown thing back in the 30s. I shouldn't say that people never traveled to Pittsburgh, but it was not an ordinary thing for people to do.
Probably when you were growing up, a lot of the men you knew worked in the steel mills. When you've gone back to the area you grew up in, gone back to visit people and to report on the steel industry. How has that changed? I mean, the steel mills are either closed down or employing very few people. I think you talked about one place where there was only 150 people employed at that mill, a mill that used to employ thousands.
That same mill now, the one in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, closed completely in 1987. When I wrote about 150 people, that was 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Since 1987, one small production shop has returned to operation. I think perhaps 30 to 50 people are employed. Yes, a great many of my former friends who were either hourly workers or supervisors in some cases were retired, lost their jobs, and very few of them now continue to work actively in the mills, although none really have reached what we would call normal retirement age of 62 to 65. But the entire industry just caved in under them, and most of them were forced to take early retirement.
I'm speaking with John Herr, and he's a senior writer for Business Week. We're talking about the subject of his new book, And the Wolf Finally Came, The Decline of the American Steel Industry. Now, you read in your book that the steel industry is really the best example of what's gone wrong with labor-management relations in the United States. So let's look a little bit at what you think has gone wrong in labor-management relations within the steel industry. But let's start a little bit with the history, when things were still good. You talk about the spirit of cooperation from the 1930s through World War II. In an attempt to keep up with increased production. What's an example of how good you thought things were then between labor and management and steel, comparatively good?
Well, the Steel Workers Union first came into the steel industry in 1936, began organizing employees. And by the late 1930s, it had some of the companies pretty well organized, especially United States Steel Corporation, which is dominant in the Monongahela Valley. And it also had organized many other smaller companies actually around the country. In the late 1930s, some of the steelworkers' leaders began promoting the idea of labor management cooperation. And in this case, what they meant was having problem-solving committees of workers and supervisors who would sit down together and decide how to make work more efficient, how to produce more, how to cut costs and avoid wastage of materials. And in some 40 companies or so, mainly small plants, it is true, they did pretty well. They helped employers that were in some trouble. One of the reasons the Steelworkers Union was willing to be engaged in this at that time was that part of their organizing drive throughout the major steel industry had bogged down in the late 1930s, and it wasn't until 1941 that they managed to organize some of the larger companies, such as Republic Steel and Bethlehem Steel. At any rate, the union was willing and did try to promote labor management cooperation and saved some smaller companies from failing, made the employees feel very good, in some cases enabled companies to raise wages. During World War II, because of the need for much higher production for war materials, the union was very willing to cooperate with management in increasing productivity, and more committees were set up at plants around the country.
How do you think it changed after the war?
Well, immediately as the war ended, it was as though the blinds were pulled down between the two sides, one in the house, one outside the house. American management at the end of World War II was really afraid that the unions generally were going to make some kind of a socialistic breakthrough and attempt to take over companies. And so management put its foot down and said that we will not allow unions to make any breach in our so-called management prerogatives, that is, the right to run the plant as we see fit. The union shall not have any voice in any kind of production matters, in pricing, in marketing, in anything to do with what we normally consider our right to run the plant or the business. And the unions actually accepted this kind of formula, even though just a few years before, some of them, including Phil Murray, the first president of the Steelworkers Union, and Walter Reuther, who later became president of the Auto Workers, these two men in particular had called for unions to exert some voice in the production process, because workers know best what is going wrong when things go wrong. Nevertheless, at the end of World War II, when management became so adamant about refusing to let workers have any voice, the unions accepted that formula, and from then on, for the next 20 to 30 years, made their main thrust increasing compensation, adding benefits to the compensation list, and improving working conditions for their members. So that was the great break period, about 1946, when the early efforts toward labor management cooperation came to a screeching halt, and really were not revived again in the steel industry's case until the early 1980s.
Well, you quote that old saying, management manages, unions grieve. And you fault the unions for accepting that, but what could they have done differently by the 1980s?
Well, you make a good point, Terry. Perhaps I sort of equivocate in the book because of that. When one side is so adamant about, especially on a principle, the principle of management prerogatives, it would have been extremely difficult, maybe impossible, for the unions to break through unless, of course, they really used their economic power. By that I mean, could they have struck the companies to demand a voice in operations? Well, then the question would have been, were their members sufficiently interested in having a voice in business operations to go on strike when, in fact, the companies were offering fairly decent wage increases in that time? The time I'm talking about is the late 40s through the 1970s. And, of course, it is questionable whether union members, the majority of them, would have been willing to strike over that issue. I just repeat, you make a good point. But on the other hand, not only did the union leaders not call for and not press it to a striking point, but they didn't even talk very much about labor management cooperation or industrial democracy anymore. Those words seemed to disappear from the lexicon of steelworkers in about a 30-year period.
Now, you criticize the steel industry in the United States for not engaging in competitive pricing, for not really staying competitive when imports started exceeding exports, for not keeping up with new technology, for spending too much money on the wrong things. Let's look at some of the things you criticize the unions for doing. You criticize them for not making workplace issues as important as wages.
Yes, because it seems to me a union really isn't serving its membership unless it gets them involved in the entire work process. I mean, one of the main problems with our industrial relations system in this country is that up until recently, it has afforded workers no part of the process at all except what little confining role he was hired to perform and do. And in most cases, the way we organize work in this country, which after all is one of the most important building blocks of a society, has been in a very narrow and confined way. It sprang out of the old idea dating back to the early years of this century that because we had such an influx of immigrants who in the beginning, because of language difficulties and relatively low education, perhaps could only perform certain skills or certain kinds of work, the unskilled work. And so that kind of work organization began 80, 90 years ago. But when the character of the workforce began to change, and it didn't take long for immigrants to begin to learn new skills and to pick up the language, nevertheless, the way management organized work did not change and has persisted even until now in many industries and in many plants of some industries. So I think that was the first and original sin, if you want to put it that way. The way we organize work simply has not been one that can take advantage of the human resources that we have in our plants.
Well, I want to talk with you more about this issue that you're raising, but first we have to take a short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is John Hare, and he's a senior writer for Business Week. We're talking about the subject of his new book, And the Wolf Finally Came, The Decline of the American Steel Industry. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. John Hare is the author of a new book on the decline of the American steel industry. He grew up in the Monongahela Valley in southwestern Pennsylvania when the steel industry was the economic basis of the region. You were just talking about how the steel unions didn't pay enough attention to the way work was organized. Do you think that the unions could have made a contribution to making the industry more productive when productivity was becoming a problem?
Very definitely. What happened was, as I mentioned before, the management organized work into such narrow tasks. You remember the scene of Charlie Chaplin in the wonderful old movie Modern Times as he worked on the assembly line and only had to perform two functions with his hands but couldn't keep up. That's although there were no assembly lines in the steel industry, that sort of organization of work nevertheless still pertained. So that when the union finally came into the steel industry in the late 30s, management demanded that management pay equal wages for equal work. Many of the workers were doing pretty much the same kind of thing, but their compensation wavered all over the lot. Management said, all right, if you insist on equity, as they called it, we will then have to make it a very scientific kind of pay scheme. And they divided work up into 32 job classes, as they called it, and the union accepted this division of work. In other words, the unions in the end, and this happened in other industries too, accepted the old Fred W. Taylor division of work that management first set up. And that became encrusted in the industries, institutionalized in the industries, so that by the 1970s, when the auto industry, steel, agricultural equipment, other industries got into trouble and went to the unions and said, look, we have too much labor in this particular plant. Would you be willing to merge some of these job classes and categories so that we can cut the workforce, perhaps cut it by attrition, not lay off anybody immediately, but as people retire and leave the workforce, we can work with fewer people but turn out the same amount of product. Most unions for a long period of time simply refused to do this. They didn't look ahead, and most unions had accepted management's refusal to look ahead in prior years. So this is how the entire system became so rigid that it was almost impossible to change. However, the unions could have changed, brought change on the shop floor if they had been more willing to make work more flexible, to combine tasks and so forth. Now some unions are beginning to do this. The Steelworkers Union and the Auto Workers Union in particular are willing to be much more flexible with the way work is organized.
Well, after an 86-87 work stoppage, there were plants that closed down in western Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Do you think that the union didn't really get the severity of the situation, that they thought that the companies were bluffing?
The 86-87 work stoppage, of course, was at U.S. Steel Corporation, now called USX. To some degree, the Steelworkers Union may have not accepted what David Roderick, the chairman of USX, had said as early as the summer of 86. That is that if there were a strike and if it continued a long period of time, the, quote, marginal plants, quote, might, in fact, not last after the end of the strike. And Roderick made the same sort of statement again in December of 1986. However, the union claims that during negotiations, they were told by the company's negotiator, or at least the company's negotiator told them, according to the union, that although the plants might not open right away, that they would not necessarily close. At least that was the union's interpretation of what he said. And then as soon as the stoppage did come to an end, in late January of 1987, four plants, in fact, were closed by the corporation, and the union felt betrayed by this. Given the state of the overcapacity in the steel market, perhaps the union should have known, without very much uncertainty, that in fact more plants would be closed. But there was a failure of communications in this case, a very tragic failure. The company simply did not tell the union ahead of time, according to the union once again, that the plants would close. And so we had the sorry spectacle of members at these plants actually voting to ratify the new agreement, thinking that they would go back to work. A few days after they ratified it, they were told there were no more jobs at these plants.
If you see the steel industry as an example of what went wrong with labor management relations, what do you think the moral is for the rest of labor? What do you think labor could learn from the collapse of the steel industry?
Well, I think both labor and management can certainly learn this. Give more challenge, responsibility to the workforce. Use human resources like they are. They're human resources. Don't try to fit everybody into a narrow mold. You can only raise productivity through human efforts, and combined with technology and with capital inputs. But certainly without human effort, nothing is going to happen. And I think one of the great, underlying tragedies of not just the steel industry, but our entire industrial relations system, is that workers have been thought of as, quote, dumb, unable to really perform. But there have been situations, especially in recent years, where companies and unions have worked together to give much more moving room to workers on the job, letting them almost act like entrepreneurs at the workplace, letting them solve problems, letting them make a lot of decisions that have been made in the past for them. And in these situations, they're finding there can be, in some cases, almost a spectacular increase in productivity.
Are you making the argument that unions should rethink their roles and management should rethink their relations with unions? Or are you suggesting that unions should disband in favor of worker management circles and teams?
Well, I certainly don't think that unions should disband.
Some people say that, unions, it's just you're asking for an adversarial relationship, and it's much better to have these worker management teams and organize management labor communications through those. You don't agree with that?
No, I don't. You see, because you can have both, although admittedly it's difficult to do. That is, when it comes time to talk about how the proceeds of the firm are going to be divided up, then I believe there still should be adversary collective bargaining. That is, the union will make its demands, although not in such a rigid way as in the past, and the two sides actually negotiate over the proceeds of the firm. But during the term of the agreement, which may be a period of anywhere from 1 year to 3 years or 5 years in some cases, the two sides should work together inside the plant in order to make work as productive as possible for their mutual interest. And it is true that some non-union managements do appear to use things like quality circles as a union frustrating mechanism. But on the other hand, quality circles or labor management participation teams or employee participation groups, they come in many names, but essentially these are problem-solving committees. They do not necessarily have to be used to keep the union out. No, I don't want to see unions disband. As a matter of fact, I don't think in our kind of democracy we can really have a democracy unless we have an independent, free trade union movement. We see that happening in Poland, certainly, and we even see in places like China and Russia now the beginnings of efforts by workers to want an independent movement. It may not happen very soon in those two latter countries, but I think the experience there and what we've seen in Poland certainly indicates that, we have to have an independent labor movement that will look out for the interests of the workers, because the interests of the workers is not always parallel to that of management.
Do you still have family in the Monongahela Valley where you grew up?
Yes, yes. I have a sister and brother-in-law, and my mother still lives right outside McKeesport.
How have they been affected personally by the collapse of steel?
Well, my brother-in-law was a lawyer, and his business declined dramatically as people began to move out and no longer had money to pay for wills and divorces and things like that. I would suspect that although it's very difficult to put this into words, I think they're affected psychologically just by the decline of the valley itself, even beyond the economic terms. It's almost horrifying to see something you've known all your life degenerate these active, bustling communities in which we all grew up are now pretty much like retirement communities, very weak and giving off a very weak pulse. And it's just debilitating to observe that. And I know some people, as a matter of fact, refuse to drive through McKeesport anymore. They live in the suburbs, and if they have to go someplace, they drive around McKeesport so they don't see the blasted places where the mills used to be. The furnaces, in many cases, have been torn down, and still a lot of wreckage left where the other buildings used to be. Some people simply refuse to drive past.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been John Herr, and he's a senior writer for Business Week. His new book is titled And the Wolf Finally Came, The Decline of the American Steel Industry. It's published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.